the College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.
Back for another week on the College Football Fix Podcast presented by USA Today Sports. Paul Meyerberg is with me. I am Dan Wolkin, back from the U.S. Open. Paul, what was your favorite match at the U.S. Open this year?
They were all my favorite. They were all great.
You can't pick just one?
How could I possibly pick between so many great matches that I watched? It'd be just impossible for me to choose between all the matches with the guys and
Do you know who won the tournament?
And Novak Djokovic won the men's.
That's correct.
That's all I got.
That's all you got. Yeah.
I know on the women's side.
To save the listeners' attention span, it's Coco Gauff. Coco Gauff.
Coco Gauff. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Thanks for reading my columns.
I did. I actually did read a lot, and I didn't. It's not like I airballed because I wouldn't watch it. I just didn't. I lost track over the weekend.
It was happening, especially the women's final on Saturday, right during all the college football. Prevented me from watching parts of some games I really wanted to watch, but that's how it goes sometimes. All right, let's get right into the news that I think everybody in college football and college sports is talking about right now. Mel Tucker suspended at Michigan State. I think you probably agree with me that it's going to be difficult to see how he returns to coaching there. I think it's now just a matter of the investigation wrapping up, whatever they find officially, and then whatever kind of settlement or contract out that they can all agree upon, that's how it ends. Mel Tucker's, as far as I can tell, as far as the contention made by Brenda Tracy, as far as what he's admitted to that we know about publicly, it's one of the all-time bag fumbles in college sports history, to use a phrase the kids like to say now. I mean, this guy, off one pretty good, remarkable year that kind of came out of nowhere. Now, let's just go back to the timeline. Mel Tucker is at Colorado for one year. Does pretty well. It was not like he certainly not – didn't do as well as Deion seems to be doing, which we'll talk about in a second, but did well enough that when Mark D'Antonio stepped down at Michigan State, which actually happened, it was very late. I think it was like late February. It was late February, right before COVID happened. I remember because I was on vacation. And so he gets the job super late in the cycle, goes to Michigan State, you know, gets in the portal, and it's like all praise and hosannas thrown at his feet because he gets the thing kind of turned around real fast. You know, Kenneth Walker, remember Kenneth Walker III out of the portal? Like, he was just – Mel Tucker was the guy. What happens? The rich booster, Matt Ishbia, who now is the Phoenix Suns, Michigan State, former walk-on basketball player for Tom Izzo, basically says, all right, we can't let this guy go. They give him this huge contract. It's like $80 million. He's set, absolutely set. They didn't have a good year last year. They were not good, and you sort of wondered whether the Mel Tucker magic was dissipating. But no real hint that there was something else going on. Well, now we find out Sunday, Saturday. No, it was late Saturday night, early Sunday morning. Thanks to our colleague, investigative reporter Kenny Jacoby, that Brenda Tracy, who, if you follow college football, I'm sure the name is familiar to you. She is a sexual assault speaker, advocate for victims. She goes around, does a lot of speaking and workshopping and you could call it coaching of, you know, college football programs and players about sexual assault and all kinds of things related to that and inappropriate behavior. And what she has contended was that, you know, there was some type of conversation with Mel Tucker. They had developed some type of personal relationship, and you know, I don't want to say too much or characterize the accusations, because you've got two different stories here, and the facts will be in dispute. But at the end of the day, what seems to be clear and agreed upon is that Mel Tucker, you know, essentially tried to pursue some type of relationship with her outside of the bounds of what she was being hired to do at Michigan State, which was speak to the football team. And so whatever else comes from that, whatever else is attached to that, however you want to look at that, I think we should all be able to agree that that was a major mistake by Mel Tucker. You know, adults are going to do what they do. You know, he has put out a statement subsequently saying he's been estranged from his wife for quite some time, which I'm not sure we knew. Again, you know, adults pursue whatever relationships you want. I would just say that when it comes to somebody who is being hired to work with your football team, it becomes really complicated and is just something that shouldn't happen. And the fallout from that, and however they disagreed on what the parameters of that relationship were supposed to be, it's going to cost him his job. And, you know, I don't necessarily feel bad for him, because he made certain decisions that I just don't think were very good decisions in his personal life. It stinks that this may be how it ends, but I just don't see any way that he can credibly come back to Michigan State under any circumstances.
Yeah, it seems like a 0% chance that he comes back. And we're going to know for sure in about 4 weeks. October 5th and 6th are the scheduled dates of these hearings. Tucker's contention is that this occurred outside the confines of his role at Michigan State. That's going to be his argument, in which case that he will rule. I mean, that essentially seems like pay me my money kind of argument, because when you boil it down, it doesn't seem like there's any way credibly that he could come back and be the coach in Michigan State. So it's an ugly situation for everybody involved, for both sides, for Michigan State, obviously, which has had its fair share of similar, I shouldn't say similar, but has had its fair share of sexual assault, sexual abuse allegations and credible allegations and court cases and so on down the line. So it's an ugly way for his tenure to end. And the question for me going forward is whether ever he can coach in college again. I don't know the answer to that question, but he certainly is never going to coach again at Michigan State.
Yeah, now you've got Harlan Barnett, who's kind of taken over as the interim coach, but Mark D'Antonio is back involved. He's going to be wearing a headset during games. You know, what's his exact role going to be? Is he going to be the de facto head coach now again? Now that comes with some other controversies, because there were questions around, you know, Michigan State's handling of certain allegations when he was the coach that caused a lot of controversy. It's just a very difficult and unfortunate situation, especially for the players who had nothing to do with any of this. And for the program, there are probably going to be a lot of guys in the portal. What do you do in terms of hiring a replacement? It's a big mess. And for Mel, you know, you and I have gotten to know Mel over the years, talked to him plenty. It stinks, because this is a guy who, you know, I do think is a good football coach, had a lot to offer the college game, one of the shockingly few black head coaches in the sport. A guy who, when you talk to him, he seemed like a very credible voice on a lot of different fronts. But these kinds of things can happen, and we've seen it before. And you can make decisions that cost you your career. I mean, you know, I think, I mean, he's made a lot of money coaching football. Like, I think he's going to be okay. He'll probably get other opportunities in the future. Maybe he goes to the NFL. But there's just certain things he can't do. And to me, this falls into the category of things he can't do. It's very, very stupid.
Yeah, it's very cut and dry. Like you said, I agree with you 100%. There are lines that you can't cross. And to cross that line, whether or not whatever happens in this hearing in a couple weeks, when you cross that line, you violated the trust and the faith put in you, not just by the school or by the guys cutting your checks, but by your coaching staff, your support staff, your players' families. So there's a violation of trust there and a lack of credibility for him growing forward. So, it's an error of a immense magnitude. And to call it an error seems so diminishing. But if you just look at him as a coach, his career as a coach was beginning to blossom. He had a chance this year to bounce back from last year's disappointment. And that chance is now over. And he probably shouldn't get another chance. Certainly not at Michigan State.
If you're Michigan State, just really quick, it's probably a little too early to talk about who replaces him. I do think if I'm running that search, I'm looking very hard at Mike Elko at Duke. I think that's a guy who fits kind of the way Michigan State operates and what they're about and the way they want to play. You know, I think he can sort of bring that Big Ten defensive mindset, toughness, and he's a heck of a coach. I mean, just look at what he's done at Duke this year.
Yeah, good call. I would want an established head coach to navigate what is going to be a lot of hurdles. If this is how it unfolds, like you said, if it unfolds with guys going into the portal in mass, which is happens almost anyway, certainly happens with a coaching change, you need a veteran guy who's worked at Power Five programs, has an idea how to build a roster, even though he's only a year or two at Duke. So, yeah, that's a nice fit. And we'll know, you know, look, if Tucker's gone, you know, legitimately, like the announcement comes the next few weeks, they'll have 2 months to pull it off. And no doubt you'll hear a number of names involved. Elko's a really good that's a really good starting point.
All right, let's get to the games we saw last weekend. I'm not going to be able to talk in too much detail because this game was just going on as I was dealing with U.S. Open stuff. I did get to watch sort of a quarter, the last quarter and a half of it, which maybe was the definitive part of the game. But Texas, the Longhorns, they're back, baby. Finally. I think they are finally back. Now, I don't know what it's going to mean in terms of the long term of the season or beyond that. Are they going to go undefeated? Are they going to do all the things that Texas thinks it should be doing? Way too far in front, but Texas looked great. Alabama did not. Like two ships passing in the night. Steve Sarkisian and Texas going one direction, Alabama going another. Make sense of it for me.
Yeah, I think what stood out to me, and this was obvious from the very first snap, and I know it sounds easy to say with hindsight, but it was obvious to me from the first series, is that Texas was just as talented, if not more so. They were just as prepared, if not more so. They were more physical. They were more aggressive. They seemed to have better depth, certainly had a better quarterback. The schemes fit their players better. They had more explosive players. They were just simply the better team. That's it. And it wasn't some smoke and mirrors. I think they are simply the better team than Alabama. It says a lot about Texas. Says a lot about where they are. It justifies the hype. Like you said, you beat Alabama in Tuscaloosa, which the team hadn't done since 07 in a non-conference regular season game. You're back. Texas is back. Alabama is going somewhere. I don't know where they're going because we have not been in this place in a really, really, really long time. I was thinking a lot, Dan, about last season with a transcendent quarterback, maybe the best quarterback in program history, one of the best in SEC history in Bryce Young. They lost two games in the SEC, whether it's by a point, by a touchdown, by 40 points, they still lost two games in the SEC. And this year they do not have Bryce Young to prop them up. SEC West might be a little bit weaker than it's been. I'm still looking at that schedule and wondering, are we looking at a three-loss team at Alabama? I think it's possible because there are a lot of things they need to fix, and I don't know, looking at this team, if it's as easy as just gaining experience. They seem to be actually lacking the personnel in certain spots to be a dominant football team, and we have not seen that since 2007, basically.
When people talk about when's Alabama going to decline or when is the dynasty officially over, sort of my sense of it has always been when they stop being really scary, when Alabama stops being the just really, really scary as an opponent. As many people might know, I thought we were in that place in 2015. We were not. I thought we might have been there when they lost that game to Ole Miss. They bounced back. They did pretty well over the next 6-7 years. But I do think we might be in that place now. It's possible 2 months from now we'll look back and say, oh, man, that's just Texas was just that good. Texas was that awesome, and Alabama's fine. But when you're talking about, well, Texas looked more talented than them, then to me that suggests Alabama's no longer a really scary opponent. And you know, why would they be? I mean, the quarterback play is not very good. I think the defense was very disappointing. I mean, wasn't that supposed to be the recipe this year? Dominant defense? They didn't look dominant. So I do think we have to come to grips now with the very real possibility that Alabama is a program in major decline, and that it might be over in terms of Saban, you know, that over-under, 0.5 national titles. How many does he have left in him? He might have zero.
He might have zero, absolutely. This feels, Dan, a lot different. I mean, not just a lot different, miles different than losing to Bo Wallace or getting bombed by Clemson or getting past the Florida hump in 08. This feels so much different because I don't know what the solution is. Like, Saban always had answers for how to get past Florida, how to get past LSU. Got to get past LSU twice, 11 and 19. Always had a response, whether it was schematic, motivational, personnel-wise. He probably has a response here to get this team back into the playoff mix. I just don't know what that could possibly be. Looking at their team, there's no one on that team, I believe, that you look at, you think, man, we got a scheme for this guy. Like, we got to stop this guy. Where are the guys? Where are the dudes? They don't seem to have them. I don't know what the reason for that is, whether it's just
well, it can't be the recruiting rankings.
No, it really can't be. I mean, you could misfire potentially, but they never really have misfired. Like, what, all of a sudden they missed on two classes in a row? Like, they're five-star guys that everybody else wanted? That just seems unlikely.
No.
So I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. And all I know is that cart ahead of the horse. But if Alabama is able to get 11-1 and run the table in the SEC, it would be the best coaching job of Saban's career, because I don't know how in the world he navigates through the SEC, even kind of a hard-to-peg, maybe mediocre SEC West, and doesn't lose one or two games, at least.
All right, well, let's look at it. All right, they're playing South Florida this week. That's going to be an easy win. But then the week after, the 23rd, Ole Miss comes in. Ole Miss has looked pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, Ole Miss, we thought that was going to be a tough one for them at Tulane. Really wasn't that tough. They look very solid so far. After that, they play at Mississippi State. You know, not a game you'd expect them to lose, but it's on the road. Mississippi State's 2-0. They go to A&M. That's another team we got to talk about.
Yep.
They got Arkansas coming in. I you know, Arkansas's 2-0, but probably really not that good. Tennessee in Tuscaloosa, the 21st of October. LSU coming in November 4th. Yeah, I think there's at least one more loss in there somewhere. I don't know which one, but there's one more loss.
Absolutely. It's impossible for me to see how they go 11-1. You know, and there's a loss out there waiting for them. They lose a game in the SEC almost every year, and that's not no disrespect. It's a tough league. If you lose a game and you go 11-1, you should play for a national championship. But this year's team is not built to do it. They're not built to do it. So if he can wring it out of them, God bless him. He's the best coach in the world. But I don't know how he does it. And look, you. I don't know if you said this to me on the podcast or you wrote it somewhere or I just saw you tweet it or something. He said before the year,
yeah,
like, I don't know if this team's any good. And people are like, well, look at Saban. He's just motivating. No, he has said before when his teams are really good. Like, if he thinks his team is good, he's not going to say, hey, we're going to win the national championship, but he's going to say positive things about his team when asked directly in the preseason whether he thinks his team has a shot. He said this year, I don't know if this team has what it takes. He was right, because I don't know either. And we have two games to look at, and neither one gives me the impression that this team is built to win at all, or even to win the SEC West. You know, I think there are multiple teams in the West who could beat Alabama on a given day and win that division. And
yeah,
look, that's just the way it is. You can't tell me otherwise based on what we've seen with our own two eyes so far.
Yeah, I call it being Saban-pilled. You know, essentially, like, we've just had so much Nick Saban in our lives that we tend to just assume that he's got control over everything and it's all going to work out just great. And that when he says to you that, yeah, he doesn't know if they're talented enough to win a national title, or you know, when he doesn't give the depth chart opening week because it would be a distraction in the locker room, like weird things he's never done before, people are sort of reading into that and saying, oh, Saban, three-dimensional chess. He's playing us all. He's playing us all. And I looked at it and go, I'm going to take the opposite way here. I think he does not feel very good about this team.
And yeah, look, he can play chess all he wants.
Don't overthink it.
Yeah, you know, he is a master tactician and a master motivator. I mean, you don't win six national championships just by winning in February or in December. You just don't. He does it because he outworks everybody. He knows how to press the right buttons. He knows how to hire. He's got checkers pieces right now, not chess pieces. So no matter what he does, I don't think the horses are there for him to have a successful season by his own standard. And that's just the way it is. And look, if this comes down to a 10-3 season, which is very, very possible, you're looking 3 years in a row without a national championship. I mean, oh my God. But the truth is, it's the first time he's gone 3 years without one. And that's just going to be something that is the story of the offseason if he comes back. Is Alabama done, or does he have one more run in him? It'll be one of the defining stories of next spring, winter, spring, summer. If they fall to 10-3, playing the Citrus or whatever, or playing a New Year's Six, but are way on the outskirts of the playoff race, that's one of the biggest stories to hit college football, at least one of the top teams in college football in quite some time.
Well, and this dovetails into where I want to take the conversation next, which is to the Texas side. And, you know, is Texas kind of looking at this now, having beaten Alabama and Tuscaloosa, and they look like they've got all this talent. Oklahoma, you know, who knows what they're going to be, but, it looks like they're going through a little bit of a transition period at Oklahoma. And you look at some of these SEC teams, including Alabama, Florida's not any good. You know, LSU's not as good as we thought, probably. You know, we put Georgia in a different category. But you look at the start the SEC's off to this year. If you're Texas, yeah, you want to win the Big 12. You want to make the playoff and win the title this year. All that stuff, put it to the side. Do you start to look at it, though, and go, man, we're getting into the SEC at a really good time right now?
Yeah. No, it's a really good point. One of the underlying storylines going into the game was making an SEC statement, and they definitely did that. We just talked about Alabama's schedule. I don't know if I would rather play that schedule, but you cannot tell me that Alabama's schedule the rest of the way is more difficult than playing Kansas State, than playing Texas Tech, than playing Oklahoma, than playing these teams in the Big 12. Texas is going to have a pretty hard run through that conference. It's not going to be easy. But, you know, I do think that in the long run, one more year in the Big 12, but you almost, as a Texas fan or maybe even as a Texas Longhorn, you're thinking, man, I can't wait to get in the SEC. I can't wait. We just proved ourselves. Like, what? You thought we were going to go 7-5 that first year? We just beat Alabama in Tuscaloosa. We're ready to rock and roll. So it's going to be hard to get through the Big 12, but I'm not surprised if that's true, that this team and this program is excited, not just for the chance to make SEC money, but to play in the SEC because they've proven that they can win at a high level. So look, they might lose to Wyoming on Saturday, but it's Tuesday after Saturday, after Alabama, and they are back as of today. So I think emotions are riding high for Texas, and maybe hyperbole is ruling the day, but I think this team has really got a lot going for it. And the program as a whole is going to turn that Saturday, I think, into something potentially very, very special.
And when we talk about the SEC and the point I just made, and you start to go through it, you know, there's a lot of 2-0 teams. A couple of them have not really been that impressive. I mean, Auburn, that was a real struggle last weekend against Cal out on the road. You know, Tennessee was kind of futzing around with Austin Peay for a while last weekend. You know, what does that mean? You know, Kentucky was in like a life or death struggle for a while to beat Eastern Kentucky. South Carolina had the very disappointing loss to North Carolina in week one. We, you know, LSU and A&M, which we'll get to in a second, and Florida. Like, what is going on with the SEC? Is this just one of those years where maybe they're not good, or, you know, is it one of those situations where the league got so offensive the last few years that maybe the defenses have slipped? Do you have any sort of theory with what's going on with the SEC?
Yeah, I had not thought about that second point, but there might be a schematic and identity issue, a culture issue at a lot of these places in the SEC. I don't know if we can say the SEC is bad. Like, it would be weird. Like, how do they get bad all of a sudden?
It's not bad.
Yeah, like, I don't know what it is. I don't know what is causing it. But the SEC, I mean, if we're really being honest, the way that they've played through 2 weeks, and if that continues through non-conference play, I hope to God that the selection committee beginning in October, November is honest about the quality of that league. You can't just reputationally give them the title of the best league in college football. They are not the best league in college football right now. They're probably the third best league behind the Pac-12 and the Big Ten, maybe the fourth, probably the third. But I hope that this kind of lingers in people's minds. You don't just earn it based off your history. The history is unimpeachable, you know, and you can't criticize it. The SEC has earned the reputation in a broader sense. But I wonder down the line if this is going to backfire. And these kind of committee members sit down in the key weeks leading into December and say, we can't put two SEC teams in here, even if one's 11-1 and one's 12-0, because the fact that the SEC is not that great. And we need to give another league the credit that they deserve for having a better season overall, a better time of it in non-conference play. So old habits die hard, old reputations die hard, but the SEC has not lived up to its billing through 2 weeks. And time is running out to make a statement for this conference. It really is. And it should, in the long run, be a detriment to the league when it comes down to rankings and the playoff poll.
You have to respect the results of non-conference games when they happen, especially when it's between two teams in power conferences, like you had Texas A&M at Miami Saturday. Frankly, a game Texas A&M you expected to win before the season. Jimbo, in year six, is that right? Six?
Oh my God. This is year six?
Wow. Miami, or is it it's either five or six. It's five or six.
Crazy.
And Miami year two with Mario Cristobal. And Miami just blew them out, really. I mean, 48-33, A&M turned it over three times. That was a big problem. Like, I don't think Miami is – I don't think we're going to look back and be like Miami is a playoff contender because they're just not. They're just not. But what does that make A&M? In a year where we're looking at it, you hire Bobby Petrino to run the offense. You bring back DJ Durkin to run the defense. Jimbo, they before 2021 season, they gave him another 10-year contract, $95 million guaranteed. Where's the progress? Like, you should be beating Miami at this stage of the Jimbo experiment. I'm sorry. That's a bad loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, I want to say one positive thing about – we can say a lot of positive things about Miami, but before going to A&M, I thought Miami played fast, which is expected, but they played loose. Like, they did not play tense. And last season, and really a lot of times for Cristobal in key games at Oregon, you would sense this anxiety and this tenseness from the players and in the way he coached the game. So I don't know if that's like a real turning point. Maybe it is, but I did appreciate watching Miami do that. They are definitely worthy of a spot in the top 25. We'll see where it goes. Like you said, I don't think it's going to lead to the top 10, but they're a solid football team. For A&M, like, I spent a quarter and a half thinking A&M was really good. I spent a quarter and a half thinking, like, well, probably both teams are pretty good. Then a quarter thinking Miami was the only good team on the field. And that's the sort of inconsistency that if you're an A&M fan or you're an A&M booster or you're someone who spends millions of dollars to help support that program, I would just be tired of it. I'd be tired of the inconsistency, tired of the feeling that your team is not prepared, tired of watching five-star, high four-star guys get on campus, look the part, and then fall flat in big moments. I would just be getting tired of this whole thing. So it's a missed opportunity for A&M because it could have, like, it would have gotten him, I think, a lot of goodwill, Jimbo, and even Petrino, if they had won this game. I really think it's a hugely, hugely missed opportunity. I still think it's like an 8-win team, which is kind of what I thought in the preseason. So it doesn't change the bottom line, but still, like, you're getting tired of these results, not just the losses, but the manner of them and the lack of preparation that you feel at times in that game for what the opponent's bringing to the table. So same old refrain, and it's getting pretty dull.
They didn't hire Jimbo to win 8 games.
No. That's a lot of millions per win, and that's not acceptable.
Yeah, and I don't really know what more there is to say about it at this point. It's the same crap we've seen over and over again. Every summer, they finally turn the corner, and then they just don't. And it's absurd. It's absurd to, you know, try to say we're going to pay somebody $70 million to not be the coach anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. But
crazier things have happened.
I am very rarely at a loss for words. I just don't know what to say. Like, we know what it is at this point.
Yeah, you know who you are at A&M. You know what you're going to get. And like you said, 8-4 might be good compared to 5-7, but it's not up to the standard. Not just not up to the standard of what A&M believes it should be. And we can have like a 5-day conversation about what A&M really should be or what they really believe they should be. But it's just not good enough compared to what you are putting in. The return on investment on Jimbo Fisher continues to be among the worst in college sports, maybe in all of sports. It's a remarkable achievement to be paid that much and provide so little in terms of satisfying the demands from your fan base and the guys who are cutting the checks.
All right, let's get to Coach Prime. Did we underestimate Colorado off week one? I mean, that was, given everything that went into that first week and the emotion and the energy they expended to win that game at TCU, they come back home, another big hyped game, at least in terms of name brand, against Nebraska. And they smoked Nebraska. I mean, Nebraska did play okay defensively, but I actually think that flatters what Colorado did even more, that they were able to score 36 points and win 36-14. I mean, Nebraska's not any good. I think we can sort of give up on that at this point. But we're going to find out, because they got some big games coming up this month. But we might have underestimated Colorado a little bit.
Yeah, I think we underestimated them in August. Right now, we are overestimating them. And that's
okay.
And like, interesting. That's like, but I want
to. So you're not ready to put them in the playoff conversation?
No. And I want to separate these two ideas. Colorado can be an incredible story, they can be an incredibly good team. Deion can be everything that we made him out to be, or we hoped that he would be, and more. All those things can be true, and they are all true. Deion has done an unbelievably good job of flipping the roster, getting them on the same page, building an offense, hiring a staff. Like, he has done no wrong, and I have to give him an A-plus grade. He's the coach of the year right now, no doubt about it. At the same time, I don't really think that you can say that they're a top 25 team off beating TCU and Nebraska. So I do want to slow things down a bit. Like you said, like, the Pac-12 has 8 teams in the AP top 25, 7 in the US LBM AFCA coaches poll. It's a damn good league with some damn good players. Better late than never, right? I think Colorado is going to be exposed to a degree when they start playing those caliber of teams. This is a definite bowl team. Like I said, Deion should be coach of the year if they can get to 7 or 8 wins. Travis Hunter or his son should go to Manhattan if they win 9 or more games. But I think we might be giving them a little bit too much credit just based off the caliber of opponent that they've beat. TCU is a bowl team. Certainly they took Colorado way too lightly. Colorado deserves credit for shoving it down their throats. Nebraska is not good. We did know this. This is not how Matt Rhule operates. He's a take your time, order, wait for the risotto kind of guy at the restaurant. So that's not surprising to me. I don't want us to overrate Colorado and then come back in a couple weeks and say, oh, how disappointing. I cannot believe Colorado is now 3-2. Like, I think we should be more pragmatic about it. They're going to beat Colorado State, and they're probably going to lose 4 or 5 games in the Pac-12. That's just my guess right now based off what I've seen. I think eventually, Dan, things are going to start coming back to earth a bit. Not to take away what they've done or what they still could do, but, like, come on. This is probably an 8-win team. Heck of an achievement, but that's not picture them as a playoff team or anything more than that.
Yeah, well, September 23rd, they got to go play at Oregon, and then they come back the next week at home against USC. So that's kind of the fulcrum of the season.
Yeah.
That will determine which way it goes.
They'll lose those games, probably. I mean, Oregon, I don't really know about Oregon. Like, Texas Tech, you knew was going to get up on Saturday, and I don't really know what to say. I think they're pretty good. I think they're like a top 12 team, I think. And USC could win a national championship. But they're going to lose those games. And I just want us to have at that point the insight to say, hey, like, it's all good. Everything is still working as intended. Like, everything is on track for Colorado. They are as good as Deion and everyone hoped they'd be through 2 weeks. That doesn't mean they're going to be so good that this is going to continue in perpetuity. This is still a process, you know? Like, he's going to do it again in the offseason. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he brought in 30 or 35 more guys, new guys this offseason. It keeps churning the roster through. That's going to be his style. So the team will get better. The depth is going to get better. And overall, the program will be even better in 24 or 25 if he sticks around. But I don't want to take anything away from what they've done. I just don't want us to be, you know, get out over our skis about Colorado.
No,
I think they're probably okay.
Yeah, but what I think we have sort of figured out, even given the competition, they have a lot of skill, and they're doing a good job getting those guys in position to make plays.
Absolutely. And that is coaching.
Yeah. And Sean Lewis, let's talk about him for a minute. He deserves a lot of credit for this offensively. I mean, he's running their offense, and it was a great hire. I mean, it was a great hire to get a guy who's a head coach in the MAC, plying his trade in obscurity. Nobody really watching. You kind of knew, you know, if you're really plugged in, you kind of knew there was a lot of credibility to his resume. But he's getting guys in position to score points. And, yeah, that's – they do have a lot of skill. They really do.
Yeah, and Dan Enos tried this many, many years ago. He left Central to go to Arkansas, I believe, as their – co-offensive coordinator, and I'm sorry if I'm messing up
Dan Enos.
Dan Enos, yeah. He tried this as a way to, like, I feel like I've hit my ceiling at Central Michigan. Like, I'm not going to get hired by Illinois from here. So let me go and work at some power places and prove myself. It didn't quite work out that way for him. It seems obvious to me that Sean Lewis, this is going to pay off big time for him. And again, credit Deion for the way that he hired his staff. He has hired a really good staff, and he's given them the reign to do what they want to do. My impression, and I don't know this, I would have no idea if it's true or not. My impression is that he hired Sean Lewis and said, go to town. Like, this is you. Like, you do you. I'll be over here, big picture, doing some stuff on this side of the ball. You run the offense. And the results have been outstanding across the board. That they've got, like you said, they've got guys who can run at the skill positions. Dylan Edwards, this freshman, runner and receiver. I mean, it's just one of 4 or 5 or 6 guys that I did not believe would be this good right away in this scheme. So I'm eating crow like a lot of people.
Yeah, and it was an incredible scene at Colorado and Boulder. The fans are totally all in. It's awesome. I think a scene that was almost equally as cool Saturday, late Saturday night, Washington State 31, Wisconsin 22, and more in a little bit in a different way. The Colorado thing, it's like right now all you see is blue skies and, you know, clear sailing ahead. Everything's going up, right? Washington State is like scratching and clawing to stay relevant after the death of the Pac-12. And they're probably going to have to go to the Mountain West or, you know, whatever ends up happening with the carcass of the Pac-12. And, like, to get Wisconsin to come up to the Palouse and then to win the game, I think it was just an awesome statement. I don't know if it means anything. I don't think it's going to mean anything. Like, You know, I don't think anyone's going to look at that and go, oh, man, you know, we really screwed up not inviting Washington State to our conference. But just in terms of a fan base and a program kind of standing up and saying, hey, we're still here, that was a great scene.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And like you said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that they'd be the best team in the Big Ten West, because on the field product has no bearing whatsoever on what has unfolded this past summer. But I'm really happy for Wazoo, Oregon State as well, the Pac-2. They're 4-0, both in the AP top 25. Oregon State, I think, could win the conference. Washington State looks to me like they could easily win 8 games, even in a really good league. Easy teams to root for. Like, if you're looking for team 2 beyond your own, these are 2 teams really easy to root for, because they're, like you said, Colorado is playing well and imagining how much better it can get. Oregon State and Washington State are like, hey, coach, can we have practice for another hour today? Because the sand's running out of the hourglass. Like, we got to milk.
They got to squeeze everything they can out of this year.
Right. So we don't root for anybody, but I'm not sad to see Wazoo and Oregon State do well. I think that's great for them. And like you said, like, Washington State beating Wisconsin in Pullman was a really, really, really cool scene for college football. Because when it comes down to it, we spend how many hours in a week? 7 times 24, 140 times 4, 168 hours in a week, and teams play for 3 of them. Well, if you're on Fox, they play for 5 of them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's 163 hours a week where we talk about everything about college football except college football, like the games. And Wazoo is like, we're going to play the games, we're going to play out the string, and we're going to do our damn best to win out. So I think that's very cool. And like I said, if you're looking for team 2, go with the Cougs or go with the Beavs, because they're easy to root for this year.
So I really wasn't paying too much attention to this game as it was happening. I only really noticed it because of the comments that were made afterwards by Mack Brown of North Carolina. They beat Appalachian State 40-34, double overtime, crazy game. Last year was a crazy game. It didn't go to overtime, but it was like 60.
No. It would. They had 63 points in the fourth quarter. I think it was 63-61 was the final.
Yeah. So 2 straight years of barely beating App State, both ridiculous games. Basically, Mack Brown afterwards is like, yeah, I'm glad we're not playing these guys anymore. And it's great for the state. It's great for the state that you know, that we have these sort of in-state rivalries. But, hey, NC State, why don't you play them from now right on? Because we're done.
This is how it went. This is like with – and I know people in our profession who do a killer Mack Brown. I think Max Olson does a Mack Brown that's really sweet. So I'm not going to try to do Mack. But he basically, with the timing, he's like, these in-state games are great for football in the state, and I would love for NC State and East Carolina to continue the tradition. You know what I mean? Like, he's like, not for me, but you guys go ahead. They need to stop playing out.
Sally and I respect the rivalry. We respect the rivalry.
Yeah, they don't want anything to do with App State anymore. Just stop playing them. I mean, it's good for, like, interest, but bad for your team. So, look, Mac is Mac. I think there was some thought that, like, oh, like, they're supposed to be better than that right now. Like, how, like, he's, like, getting scared of App State. I just think that he doesn't want that agita. You know what I mean? He's like, I don't want to worry about losing to App State. He knows all about App State. I think his brother was the coach there once upon a time, right? Wasn't Watson at App State? Whatever the deal.
Might have been, but he's from that part of North Carolina. He knows.
He knows all about it. So when he's like, I don't want to do this anymore, I think it's for real. I don't think they want to do this anymore, and I understand. That's a lot of stress on a young man, let alone a distinguished gentleman like Mac.
Are we underrating Notre Dame at
yes.
this point? Yeah, they're pretty good.
They are really good. I really and truly believe that, and I know that they haven't really played anyone. We're going to find out in about 10 days.
2 weeks.
How good they are. But I really, really believe that this team is legitimately good. They've got 3 games on this slate: Ohio State, USC, Clemson. They're not going to sweep them all, but I believe that they can go 11-1 this season. And if they do that, they deserve to be in the playoff. I think they're that good.
I mean, 42 points against Navy, 56 against Tennessee State, 45 at NC State. The Sam Hartman thing's working.
Yeah. We knew it would. I knew it would. I wasn't alone. I think we all kind of knew that it would work. NC State is not in the top 25, but let's not pretend that that's not an impressive win.
No, it's a good win. It's a good win.
Yeah, NC State is at the point now where they are – they got to issue a quarterback. Like, Brennan Armstrong is a high-volume guy, and he's going to give you what he gives you. I think they have an issue at quarterback. I think they might want to look into giving them MJ Morris a chance. That's just – I mean, that's off topic. But beating NC State at this point in terms of what Dorn has built and where they are every single year and doing it in kind of awkward conditions but still going out and getting it done, dropping 45 points, I don't want to underrate that. Like, it's not beating SC or beating Ohio State, but that's impressive. And we should view that as such. That's an impressive thing to do at NC State in your first Power 5 test, your first real test of the year, period.
I love the schedule, too, for Notre Dame coming up. That Ohio State at home on the 23rd. I mean, that's, you know, that game speaks for itself. Frankly, Notre Dame should be the favorite. Based on what I've seen of those two teams, Notre Dame's better. Notre Dame's better than Ohio State, based on what I've seen.
If they play today, I would pick them to win. No doubt about it.
Then the next week, they got to go to Duke. Tough game. We saw what happened to Clemson. At Louisville, you know, should be a win. And then home on October 14th against USC. Massive. They get Pitt at home. And then at Clemson, November 4th. I mean, it's just a great stretch of games. Good opponents, good matchups. And I will not be surprised if they sweep them. I really won't.
Yeah, I think that SEC game, if they beat Ohio State, that SEC game, and maybe I am just blanking and there's going to be a game that you say that makes me feel stupid, feels to me that would be the biggest regular season home game for Notre Dame since the Bush Bush, since they played SC, and that was 17 years ago.
Well, there was a game there was a game I went to against Stanford, like when Stanford was really good and it was like an overtime game. No.
No matter what, it's not going to match up. It's not going to match up.
Hold on a second.
You're talking maybe 12 when Stanford
would have passed. No, this was like 2014. It was the last year of the BCS. Stanford like should have been in. 13.
Yeah, that was the year they lost to Michigan State in the Rose Bowl. Okay, I remember. Yeah, wouldn't be the same.
Okay.
Wouldn't be the same. But yeah, just to answer your question, like, we agree, and I think that if you were being taken a step back and taking a look at it, you would also agree, you guys on the other end of this, that Notre Dame is legitimately good, and they have proven that through 3 weeks. And Ohio State hasn't really proven that. Like, look, they're Ohio State. They could go 12-0 and beat everybody. They can go 15-0 and beat everybody. But you haven't seen it through 2 weeks. So I don't think it's unfair for us to say today that Notre Dame should be favored in that game. I don't think that's unfair at all. I mean, we see what we've seen. And what we've seen says that Notre Dame's the better team right now. Maybe not in December, but September? Definitely.
I'm trying to keep going back to find – because I remember covering a game they played against Stanford, and it was like such a huge game. I don't know. Maybe I'm going back through it here. I don't know. God, I've been doing this too long, man.
Yeah, this is getting crazy. It's getting crazy.
Okay. All right. Well, we agree on the basics of it. All right, let's move on to this coming week, unless there was another game you wanted to get to or another team you want to talk about. All right. Unfortunately, this is not the best week coming up in terms of the matchups. In terms of top 25 teams, you know, lacing it up and really finding out. I mean, Tennessee at Florida should be a big game, but it just doesn't really feel like it. Florida's not any good. I don't know what Tennessee is. Tennessee's a 7-point favorite. I mean, I guess I'll take Tennessee, but I've just seen this situation like a million times before.
Mm-hmm.
In Florida, like, this may be the game Florida plays well. I don't know. I just Tennessee sort of messing around against Austin Peay raised some alarm bells with me.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't watch a second of that game, so I'm not qualified to give the like the particulars. But yeah, looking at that scoreboard was a little bit confusing how that played out. Maybe they were just flat.
A lot confusing.
Maybe they were just flat, or maybe they're looking ahead to Florida. Whatever. But that's your game of the day by default. And it's not quite up to the historic standard. right now, this matchup. Tennessee's done their part. Florida has not done theirs.
Yeah, it's really just not a good lineup of games. Georgia Tech at Ole Miss, I don't think anybody expects that to be amazing. You know, Washington at Michigan State, which would have been at least interesting to watch, but I mean, I guess it's interesting to watch in a different way now without Mel Tucker, but I mean, Washington seems like the much better team.
Yeah.
Minnesota at North Carolina, a matchup of 2-0 teams. Eh.
Yeah, Minnesota could make that ugly and like make them play their game and win 20-16. I don't really know. I don't think they have the firepower to keep up. We always say this, right? Like, it's the quote unquote bad weekends that almost always turn out the craziest.
Yeah, well, there might be some good games.
There might be, but even like the top teams on the schedule or the top teams in the coaches poll are not playing opponents that make you think that chaos is going to unfold. It just doesn't seem
Georgia,
that kind of
weekend. The Georgia South Carolina game historically is can be weird and quirky and whatever. I mean, Georgia's a 4-touchdown favorite. Yeah, I don't see this crazy South Carolina team competing. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that will be one that's closer than we think.
I could see South Carolina covering 28, because 28 feels like a lot.
That's a lot. It's a lot of
points. I know Georgia's awesome and they deserve it. I think they deserve it. We don't know what. I mean, playing Ball State and whoever they played week one doesn't do too much for me. 28 just feels like a lot. So yeah, that pretty much says it. Georgia's playing an SEC team week three, and they're favored by 28 points. That pretty much rounds up the weekend for you.
It will be interesting to see if the ESPN 10 p.m. game is like the highest rated 10 p.m. game they've had in forever, because that's Colorado State. Like, when's the last time ESPN did a huge number for that 10 p.m. slot? Oof. You know, that's the degenerate Pac-12 after dark, you know, chase your gambling losses at night slot.
Yeah,
but I think people are gonna tune in. I mean, Colorado State's not any good. Deion probably will run it up if he can.
No reason why he would not. Whatever you think, like, the norm is for a coach to do, Deion's not going to do that. Like, I don't see that. I could see them easily putting up 60 points if they can, and then continuing to do so. And his after the game will say, "Hey, they got to stop us," which is accurate. They do have to stop them. But to answer your question, like, yeah, that 10 o'clock game is typically garbage. Like, for example, when I was watching Alabama-Texas on Saturday and the game was ending, and on the bottom it said, up next, Auburn at California. I legitimately laughed out loud because of, like, just the idea that Auburn was playing California at 10:15 or 10:20 at night on a Saturday. So
it's
that's going to be the game
matchup.
It's so weird. And it was
the culture, the biggest
so
culture
bad.
Clash, biggest culture clash in college sports.
Yeah, it's Hugh Freeze and Merkley is worth. They could hire Deion's production team to follow him around for the game. I think, I'm going to be watching that at 10 o'clock because, A, I have nothing better to do with my life, and also because it's fun to watch Colorado. Everyone's going to watch that, and I would bet you that, yeah, on sometime on Sunday or Monday morning, ESPN PR will send out a message saying, another record, Colorado draws
yep.
4.4 million viewers, the largest 10 p.m. slot since 2013 or something, like whatever it is. Colorado's going to keep breaking records no matter what.
The television networks are very thrilled about everything that's gone on in Colorado this year, as are we.
I believe that Game Day and Fox Game
Day. I think they're both going there. Yeah, they're both going to Boulder. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
amazing.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
Amazing. Yeah.
All right.
Hey, baby.
That's going to do it for this week's episode of the College Football Fix presented by USA Today Sports. I need to get some sleep. I've not slept very well the last 2 weeks. The covering the U.S. Open does not do wonders for your sleep schedule.
Well, what's the schedule like? You're getting in. What were you doing? Like, I hope you weren't getting there at 10 a.m. You were getting there in the early afternoon maybe and hanging out through the night game.
I was getting there, you know, between 11 and 12.
Okay. And then you were checking up around midnight?
Pretty much.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But then
you got to go back into the city. You got to take the train to back into the city. And it's long days.
That's not quite like Olympics level time commitment. But I think that's a pretty close approximation. Like when we do Olympics, or when I did Olympics with you, that was every day was 17 or 18 hours with the travel.
Yes.
And I would sleep about 4 or 5 hours and then do it again. So that sounds about right. I love those. Those are the best.
To they
work
are great.
And then work and then work and know where your work is coming from. Know when your work is due. Know what your work's going to be tomorrow. From a professional basis, there is nothing better than that.
It's fun. And especially the Open. I love the Open. So I'm not complaining. I need sleep, man.
Yeah, well, it's Tuesday.
I got to catch up.
Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Tell you the truth, you could probably sleep through most of Saturday. So you're going
to
catch up.
All right. Well, for Chandler, our producer back in the studio, Eric Smith, our college sports editor listening in, and for Paul Meyerberg, I'm Dan Wolkin. We'll talk to you next time on the College Football Fix.
The College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.